Recordings has started.
Hey, thank you, Darren. Well, welcome, everyone. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, and welcome to the INGO Curative Rights Protection Mechanisms Working Group call on the 16th of November, 2017. On the call today, we do have George Kirikos, Petter Renforth, Mason Cole, Jay Chapman, David Maher, Osvaldo Novoa, and Philip Corwin. We have apologies from Paul Keating. From staff, we have Mary Wong, Dennis Chang, Steve Chan, Barry Cobb, and myself, Michelle DeSmiter. As a reminder, please state your name before speaking for transcription purposes, and please utilize your mute button when not speaking. At this point, you may begin, Petter.
Thanks, Petter here. I have two initial things. First, I note in the chat room about next week, and success, there will be no call next week, so I hope we can have a very efficient meeting today. Waiting for Mary's note there on this topic. I start with the first point that is actually, okay, next call will be November 30. Thanks for that. The point there where we normally just skip quickly the updates of statements of interest, but this time we actually have at least one. Bill.
Oh, yes, thank you, Petter. Yes, I've changed my statement of interest. I've, as of November 6th, I shuttered the operations of Virtual Law LLC, which is my legal and consulting firm, and began employment in the legal department of VeriSign, and I have updated my SOI with ICANN the other day. So, but I will be continuing as co-chair of this working group to see our work to a finish and hopefully a successful finish. Thank you.
Thanks. And good to know that you will still be working together here with us, as we are definitely also in the, hopefully, in the very final part of our long-time work on this topic. And thereby, I go over to point two, review feedback from Open Community Session at ICANN 60 and the GAC Communique. And you have all hopefully seen the protocol from our presentation there at ICANN 60. I'm trying to summarize a little bit of the comments from the audience, noting that although we didn't receive any specific comments or questions from him, but it was nice and interesting to see Jaron Marvi, our CEO, participating for the main part of that session. So I noted that Nick Wood had one question: if the future review of the UGRP would reopen what we conclude here in our working group, or if it's, so to speak, shut down now and becoming a permanent solution. And of course, we. I think it's important that we work separately with our topic and come to a conclusion that we can present and that ICANN Board can make a decision on. But also, as we all know, and some of us are participating actively in that working group as well, there is another one that is dealing with starting fairly soon with the URS, and then as the second part, looking at the UGRP. And there is a charter questions for that working group, both for the URS and for the UDRP, but it's not closed and not possible to add questions and issues on. So we don't know. It may be that this topic can also come up in that working group, and everybody, the members, are also free to make their comments on this topic. But having said that, at least from as I see it, we should definitely not wait further on the work in that working group to make our conclusions and propose our decisions. And then I bring it over to Phil, that is also one of the co-chairs of that working group. Please.
Yeah, thank you, Peter. As one of the three co-chairs of the RPM review working group, we don't expect to even begin to organize our inquiry into the UDRP till late next year and really to get into the substance in 2019. So whether we're facing somewhat of the same issue there in that phase one of our work, we have to review the uniform rapid suspension and see how it's working and recommend whether any changes and that should be made, as well as the overarching question of whether it or any other new TLD RPM should become consensus policy for legacy TLDs. But we don't know, so we have to review the URS and possibly tinker with it, but not knowing whether in our UDRP work, which will be subsequent to that, we'll be dealing with any proposal for some kind of expedited form of the UDRP, and if we did that and if there was any support for it, we'd have to decide whether that was an addition to URS or a substitute for the URS and phase out the URS. So it's just the nature of the work that we have to take these things sequentially, but I don't see how any of that would impact reaching final work on this, which is a very narrow issue on use of the existing RPMs as they now stand by IGOs.
Thanks, Phil.
Hope that's helpful.
By the way, a practical question I see on the screen is it open for everybody to scroll on the ICANN transcription, or is it locked because
it's
I
scrolling.
Realized that?
It is scrolling.
Good.
Oh, and Peter, I also wanted to add that at the meeting in Abu Dhabi, not only was our CEO, the ICANN CEO, in the meeting, but while you were speaking, when he left a little early, he made clear to me, and then I ran into him later in the meeting, that he wants to keep close watch on this and be helpful addressing our final report when it is issued. So I think it's very helpful to this working group to have that level of interest and involvement offered by the CEO.
Thanks Phil. And I definitely agree that this is a topic that needs to be that someone on that position needs to be interested and active in, as there are, as you know, different groups of interest that talking about this solution, and whatever we came up with, it will not be seen as the 100% perfect solution for any groups of interest, but the best that we could came out with, and I certainly hope that it can be so accepted as so that it can also remain for the period that we have discussed previously and not be changed again, for instance, when the other working group starts dealing with the UDRP issue. We we're trying to find a solution that will work for some years and some cases. Okay, it's going down a bit more. Orfil, did you have another comment on this?
No, sorry, I'll take my hand down.
Okay. Yeah, then I'm trying to summarize here, and then everybody that was on the meeting, and especially Phil, if you have any further comments on this, please step in. But I think the next the interesting issue was John Rodriguez's questions and comments. John Rodriguez from the USPTO on the Article 6 tier, and that he said that that many of the notifications that are submitted and that go through this process frequently do not fall within the parameters as proper subject matter when it comes to Article 6 tier. He said that the modified version, where it's not dependent on the panelists in deciding whether or not standing is determined based on the completion of the notification procedure under Article 6 tier, it's creating a link because we're still allowing a connection to be established between the filing procedure and the establishment of rights. What we tried to explain was also to go back to our first proposal when it comes to Article 6 tier, and that we in fact have in our discussion changed that a bit. So Article 6 tier would be one way of many to identify, and not the one and only. Also that we had also from Richard Hill that dealing with UDRP cases, and also that it's He noted that independent on the documentation that a complainant file in the UDRP, panelists may be able to ask for more information, and he said that it's to him it was at least comfortable with the Article 6 tier and the references to other identification documents that we have proposed so far. And then we also had from Sarah Deutsch a question on how many of these cases we might anticipate. And there was lucky to had Brian Beckham around the table, because he could say that it was less than a dozen cases during the 20 years. Yes, in fact, he remembered two cases where IDOs had been connected. And
may I step in?
Yes, George.
Yeah, it was actually George Chris, for the transcript, that said it was less than 10. I said it in this chat room, and then Whitebow's Brian Beckham suggested it was only two.
Yeah.
I went back to our paper, and I posted the link in the chat room because I posted on the mailing list, and there are 10 cases cited in our actual report. So his answer was wrong. And
10 cases. Okay. Yeah, well, still, we're talking about 10 cases for the past 20 years.
Right, but just overstating it almost by an order of magnitude.
Yeah, that's the conclusion. So, thanks for that clarification. And it was more of a question: how many cases we're talking about? And then, of course, it could be discussed if the problem that we have discussed here for the IGOs, if it's just these kind of few cases, or if it's the lack of the jurisdictional immunity issue that actually makes IGOs to not use the system. We had one, I think it was Richard, that also this was on a meeting that said he had worked for the ITU for 12 years, and they had only one situation where they thought it might be appropriate to run a UGRP, but they didn't because of the jurisdiction issue. Yeah, as George says, they can cite Article 6 there, but it's irrelevant as an evidence, but doesn't mean that the panel needs to accept it. And that's, it's the same when it comes to trademarks that are not traditionally registered. It's up to the complainant to provide evidence of the name rights that could be considered as trademark rights or related to trademark rights, even if it's not registered in a traditional trademark registration system. We also had from Richard and from Brian Beckham reference to the Nominet solution, and I think that's something that we will discuss at point three on the agenda today. So I'll leave it to that. But that was the first time that the Nominet way to deal with it came up and was briefly discussed. So that's what I have as a summary from the discussion and questions from the open community session. I don't know if anyone wants to add something. Yes, George?
Yes, George, so the transcript again. During the Abu Dhabi meetings, I was assured that option number 6, which was removed from consideration by the PDP and the last survey, would be put back on the agenda, but I don't see it on the agenda, so I want to make sure of that. Also, the results of the survey, instead of just the top level that was shared, I'd like to see the individual responses instead of anonymized results, as well as any of the comments that were made by the participants. And then in the email, I also mentioned, you know, it would be nice to have a risk analysis done. That doesn't have to, that wasn't brought up at Abu Dhabi, but I might as well bring it up now. Thanks.
Thanks. I would say when it comes to the comments on our vote, I'm not sure if it's sent out yet, but you will definitely see it after this meeting, although we have, it will still be a neutral we will not identify your personal comments, but you will see what comments we have got on each specific topic there. And when it's come to what do you call option six, as you already all know that it was not unilaterally removed. It was more, as I see that, more accurately removed as a result of the of our working group discussions and of following one of the basic idea behind option six, the judicial proceedings that could be limited to just deciding on the question of domain ownership that was developed and incorporated into the new option C. But it also that with option six, it there was some legally difficult position by distinguishing between in rem and in personam actions, which not only are recognized in the same way in all jurisdictions, and I think that's especially when it comes to civil law jurisdictions, but also can create a problem in jurisdictions that have not yet and may not recognize domain names as a feasible property. I said, well, we have put in some of it in the three options that we decided in the working group to have out for voting. Yes, George.
Okay, George Gregos again for the transcript. Here's what happened. We had six options. Option number five was obviously flawed, so that was removed. But the chairs came up with a document that only had options A, B, and C, with option number six unilaterally removed. But the preface of that document actually said that they were fully, you know, they were incorporated into the other options, which was untrue. Like option number C didn't incorporate option number six at all. And so what happened was, you know, we were having PDP calls, and, you know, supposedly we were going to incorporate, you know, option number six into option C. But then, you know, a meeting got canceled, and this, you know, survey came out of nowhere, which said that those options A, B, and C were the final options. And so, you know, that's just, you know, in my view, that's misuse of the authority of the chair to have, you know, said that, you know, these options were going to be considered, and then just to unilaterally remove it. And so, you know, I'm sitting here with that was a very valid option. I spent thousands of dollars of my own money, actually, to research options six through my lawyers. And the purpose of option six was to actually reduce the number of instances where that lack of court access, reduce the number of instances where the immunity is actually even in play. So it's a very valid option if the goal is to reduce the number of these edge cases that exists. And so for it to not even be, you know, under consideration by the PDP is, you know, totally unacceptable to me. And, you know, if I have to write a minority report, I'm sure I'm not going to be the only one, because I know from my personal emails that I'm not the only one that feels this way. And so, you know, we can also talk about why option C is not acceptable. And I can point to the actual even transcript of this call, which I'd like to actually do at this moment since it's early in the call. If people would turn to page 15 of the document that's on the screen, it talks about actually one of the basic principles of ICANN itself. And this is Phil's words on page 15. Going aside, there's actually a book by Ray Dalio at the moment, Successful Billionaire, titled Principles, and, you know, caused me to think deeply about this issue of what are the principles that, you know, ICANN stands for, what this PDP stands for. And in the middle of that page, it says, and we did not change that, and this is Phil's words, we did not change that because we noted that ICANN curative rights processes are in addition to and not a substitute for existing statutory rights. And importantly here, ICANN has no power to extinguish registrants' rights to seek judicial redress. And let me explain that a bit more, still Phil's words. Number one, these rights protection mechanisms are protecting rights created in the legal system. They're not ICANN-created rights. ICANN is not a legislature with any authority to create independent rights. The EDRP and URS exist to provide a faster and less expensive way to protect trademark and certain other rights. And it goes on. So the key is that ICANN doesn't have the authority to create these independent rights. Now, option C, what it does is it's taking the ICANN UDRP as a given and is attempting to fix that, not noting that it's the ICANN UDRP itself that is creating a new right because of that loophole that exists, that edge case. And so the only reasonable option is option A, which is to eliminate the freshly created right, i.e. the elimination of the legal avenue directly. And so, you know, I'm very disturbed that people are not recognizing this, and I'm not the only one, obviously, through Paul Keating's email today and the other votes, and we don't know the anonymous people who, you know, voted for option C, but I'm not sure if they're, you know, even active participants of this working group or if they've been, you know, worried about, you know, this ongoing fear-mongering that the GNSO Council is not going to accept the report. And one other point I want to make before I let Phil speak was next, is that back in January when we issued, or earlier in the year when we issued the final report, the draft report, we were all basically in favor of option A, which was to vitiate the UDRP, set aside the UDRP, because that directly addressed the problem. I want to ask anybody who's in favor of option C, what actually changed? What new facts and new analysis have actually existed that now make option C preferable to option A? I would submit that there's actually not a single new fact, not a single new piece of analysis, other than the politics that some people are not going to like it, even though it's the principle-based solution. And so I'll leave it at that.
Well, yeah. Thanks for your comments, George, and I can understand that I know that you are in favor of option A, but having voted on it, there are always solutions for minorities and majorities. So, and Phil, you were cited several times, so I'll leave it over to you.
Yes, thank you, Peter, and I couldn't help but be struck by the brilliance of my own thoughts when they were read back just now. Just joking. Let me respond to a couple of things here. Number one, I don't want to make a big deal on this, but George has stated several times in writing and now just orally that he believes the co-chairs have abused their authority. I reject that categorically. The co-chairs have been very careful to not cross any bright line in abusing their authority to be administrative and not push toward a particular sharing information about internal ICANN developments is not the same as pushing a particular policy goal. We had a full discussion, and the vote could have gone the other way, and then that wasn't the will of the working group. But if anyone who's a member of this working group feels that the chairs have abused their authority, please go ahead, and that they've been treated unfairly, go ahead and file a complaint with the ombudsman and have it investigated. But I reject any suggestion of that. On option six, I thought this working group had a fairly robust discussion of that and had said it wasn't a good idea for several legal reasons, but I would invite George to take the current language of that option and add what he thinks should be added to it to make it not acceptable, but better in his view, and the full working group can discuss that and either accept it or reject it. So it's not, nothing's final at this point. The vote we took was to get a sense of the working group, not to make final decisions. We'll have a full binding consensus call, hopefully within a few weeks. On the sharing the votes, we're going to share all the information except who voted which way, because it's the view of the chairs that people engaged at that vote with an expectation of privacy. If members want to share how they voted, that's fine, but we shouldn't be the ones to reveal what people may have regarded as a private ballot. And finally, in regard to further impact analysis, I think personally that we've already done that and that there's no additional need. But again, we, the co-chairs, will respect the will of the working group. If there's a sufficient number of working group members who believe that we need additional risk analysis before taking a final consensus call, we will consider that. So that's all I had to say, and I hope that's helpful, and we can move on to the rest of the agenda. Thank you.
Thanks. And yeah, I said to George, maybe you can in between from now and the next meeting write a little bit on the specific language on option six if you wanted that. We can have it up to and discuss that. Having gone through the open community session, we also had the GAC communique, and from what I see on that, I may have missed something in that that communique, but I see more the same language as we have seen before. Kind of summarize that, although the ICANN community is still awaiting the final report for the PDP on IGO access to security rights protection mechanism, preliminary communications indicate that the working group's proposal will conflict with GAC advice on the issue and GAC input on to the PDP, as well as the comments of over 20 IGOs who submitted comments to the working group's draft report. The board plays an important role in ensuring the proper application of ICANN bylaws and the GNS operating procedures, and the GAC expects that the basic safeguard would be close board review of GNS policy recommendations, especially where such recommendations directly contradict GAC advice. And well, as we all know, we have invited and frankly also had on meetings both GAC and IGO representatives. We have considered their specific needs and inputs during our work these years, and it's at least my personal point of view that we have considered their inputs in the same way as we have considered all other groups of interest in this topic. So, but we have seen this general comments from GAC during all the time we have worked on the topic, even if we have actually based on some of the Jack and I Joe comments on our first initial paper. They seem to be not satisfied with the result, but again, that's, and we have discussed it before, and I'm still talking in my personal point of view that I think the option C is the one that could actually be most the most efficient, the most workable way to deal with this specific topic, and to find a solution that could be acceptable. Also, counting on the rather limited number of cases what we're talking about. Phil.
Thank you, Peter. I just had a few personal comments on this GAC communique. My initial reaction on seeing it when it was issued in Abu Dhabi was that it was softer than previous GAC statements, which were more aggressive and approaching great concern and kind of almost condemnation of this working group. I think it's good to know that we have a CEO and board members who are interested in our work and want to see it get proper consideration by the GAC. And you know, I appeared on a panel discussing the work of the RPM working group before the GAC in Abu Dhabi, and during that I mentioned that I was co-chairing this, and I know they had concerns, but the one thing I would ask is that they actually read our report before taking a, before providing the board with GAC advice. I don't know that GAC members will do that, but it really, if the GAC's going to provide consensus advice to the board, and we don't know yet what that will be, they ought to at least take an hour and read the results of our 3 years of work before decide. It should be based on something more. Well, they didn't do what we asked them to do. The GAC members don't have a lot of background in the nuances of this issue. So far as the values of openness, transparency, and inclusion, this working group has been completely open and inclusive. We have we did extensive outreach to encourage participation by GAC members and IGL representatives. They chose not to become members. That's not on us. That's on them. Everything we've done is transparent. There's transcripts. There's documents. So far as representativeness, if there is any attempt to besmirch the work of this working group and we issue our final report with allegations that have been captured by any particular group or did not represent enough the different components of the ICANN community, the co-chairs already reviewed that with staff. And while this is a small working group, there's no requirement that every working group have dozens and dozens or even hundreds of members, but we have had sufficient participation from different parts of the ICANN community, I think, to refute any such allegations if they should arise. So, but, you know, so far as working with the GNSO, the GAC can provide informal input. Their formal way of providing advice is to the board if it's consensus advice. We expect that the board will closely review our decisions, I believe that the board will decide that we've done an excellent job of dealing with some difficult issues and fully considering the relative rights of the parties that we're considering, IGOs as complainants, as domain registrants, as well as ICANN's proper role in creating non-judicial alternatives to judicial proceedings, and that we have in fact respected and kept ICANN within its remit when in fact the approach that GAC has been suggesting would go in the opposite direction and have ICANN either creating rights or taking away legal rights of their own citizens. So I'll stop there, but overall, we'll try to continue to have the co-chairs and others will continue to have a dialogue with the GAC, urging them to give our final report real scrutiny. You know, read it before you issue a final opinion on it. But I did view the tone of this as softer than prior GAC statements on this issue and on the work of this working group, so I'll take some comfort in that. Thank you.
Thanks, Phil. And also, when it comes to the questions and discussions we had before with IGO members and GAC members, when they first suggested or discussed further external expert on some of the topics, we also got the input that it would be nice to see a final suggestion on this topic. We have worked so long with it, and whether it is 100% acceptable or not, we need to reach a conclusion and come up with our final proposal pretty soon. And then, as we noted initially today, it's of course possible to discuss it in the other working group, and when that group comes up to the phase two and start dealing with the UBRP topic. But I personally would like us to finalize our own solution and suggestion on this specific topic, and do not throw it over to another working group and for another time of work. Okay. Let's say that we are finished with point two of today. Then we have the nominate appeal process, and it was at our community session at ICANN 60. We had some note from Brian Beckham, and that they had had a panelist meeting in Geneva where Paul Keating participated and made a comment about whether IGOs would be amenable to accepting a nominate-like appeals process in the context of this security rights protection discussion. Nominate is the provider for the UK domains, and they manage a process that's as many of the CCTLD dispute resolutions are similar to the UDRP with few adjustments, and I would say that all CCTLDs that have looked at the UDRP as a base for their own national dispute resolution policy, I've also got used the possibility to to make the practical amendments that works for that specific legislation. So obviously there is an appeal phase, and we promised to have it on the agenda. Unfortunately, Paul could not participate personally today. It would have been good to have his comments on the topic, but you see it here. I don't know if you have offer the possibility to start it. I also note from Abu Dhabi, we had one comment from Richard that he said that he think that this may still be the same problem as the appeal process does not exclude the jurisdiction's national court case. So. As Mary said, the appeal process essentially requires a panel appointed from amongst an expert review group. I'm not sure if I have to say that I've not studied it in the details myself, but from what I remember when I first looked at it, it may well be that we could use some of the language in this policy to add to our own suggestion when it comes to the possible not appeal but the final neutral panelist way to solve an IGO dispute. So we have the paragraph 20 here you can see on the screen. So either party shall have the right to appeal a decision, which is something that we have also discussed as a possibility. And the statement of intention to appeal should only contain sufficient information to make it clear that an appeal is requested. The statement of intention to appeal should not contain the actual grounds or reasons for appeal. An appeal notice should be not extend 1,000 words. It should set out the detailed grounds and reasons for appeal. And there's a 3 day time period to make the statement and pay the fee, and within 10 days of receiving the appeal notice, the other party may submit an appeal response with the same limitation of words. What's interesting here perhaps is the chairman of the group of experts, member of the expert review group of his or her choice, and the next available 2 members of the expert review group appointed by rotation from the list, or members of the expert panel proposed by the chair. As I said, I'm not study this in details, but what we suggested from our working group was that the party should have the possibility to point out one of the panelists each. Phil.
Yeah, thanks, Peter. Yeah, this nominate policy, and there's another document that relates to it as well. It's a lot to process. I did want to look up an email that Paul had sent, and it's a shame Paul can't be with us on this call because this is his suggestion that we look at nominate on. He copied you and I and Mary. Paul sent an email on November 1, Wednesday, November 1, and he said we could share this with the group publicly, so I'm not violating any confidence by reading this. Paul made clear in the email that his first choice was still for the that if the IGO succeeded in the successfully asserting judicial immunity when the registrant brought an appeal from a UDRP, that the underlying UDRP should be vitiated. That's a position that the working group has considered that did not receive majority support. Then he went on my second position is a UDRP nominate-like appeals process. The panel should be carefully selected. I'd require specific training and a more law-based process that avoids the watered-down analysis now prevalent in the UDRP, particularly in regard to the first element, which would require a more traditional trademark infringement test, honoring the actual language of the policy. Then he goes on to note that he suggested an alternative based on his perception that IGO's concern was mainly due to possible monetary judgments. The suggestion was to prohibit a SI claim. I'm not sure what SI stands for. Maybe if the respondent in turn waived any claim to monetary damages, this would be a small price to pay, as most judgments are virtually uncollectible at any rate. Then he said this was not adopted largely because it would work only if the IGO signed a separate waiver as part of the UDRP process, which is unlikely. So that, I just read that to give some background on Paul's thinking, since he is not with us today. But what I would like to raise, and I don't have any direct experience with the nominate appeals process. I don't know if any working group members do. But I think we should try on this call to determine whether working group members think there's any value in looking more deeply into this. We've been looking at a process if the IGO successfully asserted judicial immunity, then and only then would it be required to go to an appeals process, which would be limited strictly to disposition of the domain name. There wouldn't be any question of monetary damages, injunction, or anything like that. It would be performed under the law of the nation in which the judicial appeal had been brought and all of that. And this nominate process, as I understand it, is an internal appeals process. It doesn't eliminate the ability of .UK registrants to seek judicial review, as I understand it. So it doesn't deal with that question. And also our own proposal stated that in the alternative to going to a judicial appeal, that if the domain registrant preferred to go to arbitration directly and the IGO consented, they could skip the judicial part and go straight to determination under national law, the relevant national law regarding domain disposition. So given that, I think I want to see if others have statements on this, but I think the decision before the working group is whether we want to think there's enough merit to the nominate approach, which is an internal appeals approach, and I'm not sure how it would work since we've already decided we can't eliminate the ability of the registrant to seek judicial review of an adverse UDRP ruling, whether we want to spend time on this or whether we want to check the box and go on to working toward a final report. So I'll stop there, and I hope that some other members of the work group, I see George's comments there in the chat room. He doesn't seem disposed to look at the nominate process, but I welcome the views of other working group members. Thanks.
Thanks. Just a further note that I think that actually, Paul sent out to the full working group, but he had some final comments on the UDRP appeals process that is said that he's in favor of an appeal process for all UDRP cases, and he's mean that the appeal process is not a replacement of the mutual jurisdiction certification. So even if he also answered the questions about how it works in when it comes to .UK disputes, there is still the risk or the slash the possibility to have the case taken to a court decision. But what he says is it's instead it should be an economical means of correcting poorly reasoned decisions by inexperienced or biased panelists. And he strongly disfavors any appeals process that would be unique to IGOs or that would remove the protections of Section 4K or the mutual jurisdiction certification. So, it said what I've, and I'm looking at the chat, also when it comes to comments on this. I suggest that we can have a further look and see if there is some language or some specification in this system that we can use in our own proposal, although not thereby not saying that we should add a new process. We have already one of our possible solutions. Call it appeal decision by a three-member panelist, if the parties so accept, instead of taking the case to a court or as a second step after the court decisions on the neutrality. So, as I said, it could be some specific words or language in this system that. That we can use, but not taking in the whole system in what we already have there. And yes, we have reached the 1 hour mark. As George says, 90 minutes. Normally they are. Today it was 60 minutes. So I suggest, as we are some minutes past now, that we at this stage talk about the next steps. And here perhaps I can leave it over to Mary, say something about how to proceed here.
Thanks. Peter, hi everybody. This is Mary from staff, and so this is something that we were just kind of trying to work on our end, given the possibility that we may want to devote a little bit more time, at least, to a mechanism similar to the nominate process. We had initially aimed to provide a draft final report by the end of next week. Just so the group knows, we have pretty much completed most of the draft final report, except obviously for this recommendation. So what we can do is provide Petter and Phil with a first look at that draft, you know, minus this piece, and the working group could try to wrap up this discussion perhaps on the 30th or thereabouts so that we can then complete the draft. Petter, Phil, I don't know if that's something that would work or if there are other things that you think we should try and accomplish before the 30th in terms of wrapping up this particular topic.
Thanks, Mary. Petter here. I think that would be excellent if we could do, and then have something to send out to the full working group with as fast as possible before our next upcoming meeting. And then we have actually we have two inputs to consider how it could be used in a suggested final report. And one is, of course, the nominate appeal process. If there's anything there, we can use. And then I'll also put it over to when it comes to option six, and if George, if you can send out also a short suggestion on a specific language to add to the current description. And it seems that what we're talking about here are two inputs when it comes to the arbitration part of it. Okay. Just scroll down on the agenda here. I think that that was the agenda for today and the topics for today. So next week we will have no meetings, but we will work continuously with what, as soon as possible, will be our final report, and then we'll meet again within 2 weeks from now. Thanks. Yes, the 90 minutes, definitely we need that for the November 30 meeting, because I think we'll have kind of interesting document to go through and discuss before we decide upon it. Thanks.
All right. Thank you, everyone. Meeting has been adjourned. Operator, would you mind stopping the recordings for us and disconnecting all remaining lines? Enjoy the remainder of your day, everyone.